I hate computers, he said. Any decent person would, I said. Did you locate Mary Lou Buckman? Yes, she was employed with us from 1986 until 1991. In what capacity? Resource development. Which means? She was a geologist. She looked for new sources of water. Chapter 42. Hawk and I were looking at the guns laid out in the dining room, where Vinny had affectionately arranged them. There were two AR-15s, three pump-action shotguns, a Winchester 45 carbine, a Heckler & Koch with a 20-round magazine, a Jaeger Hunter with a scope, a 44 Ruger Bush gun, and a BAR. "Who owns the BAR?" I said.
"Bobby Horse," Vinny said.
"Bonnie and Clyde use those," Hawk said.
"Don't know nothing about Bonnie and Hoosis," Vinny said.
There were extra handguns on the sideboard. A Walther P-38, two Brownings, a Glock 17, and three Smith & Wesson 357 revolvers. The ammunition for each weapon was stacked beside it. Most of the guns were stainless steel, and they gleamed happily in their orderly arrangement. The ammunition boxes were mostly green or red, depending on who made them. The room looked sort of festive.
"Who brought lever action?" Vinny said.
"Me," I said. "A sentimental favorite." Vinny shook his head and went on wiping. On the floor in front of a side window, two pieces of duct tape formed a large X. "Firing position," I said.
"Yeah," Vinny said. "Got five positions marked. Give us fields of fire, cover the whole house. Got some other positions located up in the hills, case we want to bail out of here, cover any approach."
I nodded.
"How come you got that Winchester?" Vinny said.
"Sentimental," I said. "I had it in Laramie. My uncle bought it for me."
"You only got five shots in the sucker, and you got to jack each one up before you shoot."
"I'm not big for volume," I said. "I'm a careful shooter."
"Well, I hope you ain't feeding shells into that thing while one of the Dell monsters come at you with a Tech 9.
"Me too," I said.
"What are you packing for a handgun?" Vinny said.
I pulled my T-shirt up to show him the gun on my belt.
"Same thing," Vinny said. "2-inch barrel, 5 rounds in the cylinder."
"Sometimes I carry that Browning," I said.
"You should," Vinny said. "You can't hit a whale in the ass with that little Smith & Wesson, unless you're right up on him."
"I plan to be right up," I said. Vinny shrugged. I was beginning to feel defensive. "I like it," I said. "It'll knock you down if you're close. It's light to carry, easy to conceal, and it works good. I can carry it in an ankle holster if I need to." Vinny nodded again. With a small camel hair brush, he was dusting the rear sight of the BAR. "Besides," I said, "it's cute."
"Yeah, sure," Vinny said, "and it matches your tie. Swell."
Vinny's full attention went back to tending the guns. He was like a bitch grooming a puppy.
"Bobby Horse waiting on us," Hawk said, "to go look at the Dell."
"Cholo's not going?"
"Cholo say he already been there."
"Doesn't want to make the climb again," I said. Hawk nodded. We were quiet for a time, watching Vinny fuss over the weapons. "There's a lot going on here that we don't know about," I said.
"We used to that," Hawk said.
"And the damn woman is at the center of it."
"We sort of used to that, too, ain't we?"
"Yeah, but she's also our employer."
"She your employer, Bobo. You're my employer."
"You're such a stickler," I said.
"Chain of command, boss."
Vinny had the cylinder open on one of the 357s, and was studying it, using his thumbnail to reflect light into the barrel. Then he nodded to himself and gently closed the cylinder.
"Vinny should have been a father," Hawk said.
We watched Vinny for a minute.
"Something bothering me," Hawk said.
"Only something?"
"Mary Lou and her hubby come out here on their summers off and run this little horseback gig," Hawk said.
"Until he got fired from coaching," I said. "Then they moved out here full-time."
"Who the fuck gonna come out here for summer vacation?"
I nodded. "That is bothersome," I said. "Maybe it was because that's the only time they had off."
"Maybe," Hawk said.
"Or not," I said. "And why here?"
"Maybe you and me need to figure out what's up out here before we charge up to the Dell and shoot everybody's ass."
"What's the most important thing in the desert?" I said.
Iron Horse Champagne, Hawk said.
Next to that, I said.
Water.
Our client was a geologist whose job it was to find new water sources.
And she was Boffin the chief of police.
Yep.
And Ratliff the producer.
Yep.
And she had enough money to hire you to find out who clipped her hubby.
And they all come from L.A., I said,
where some bad man tries to chase you off the case.
And back in Potshot, I prevail over a couple of stiffs from the Dell, and the town fathers treat me like Charlemagne.
Vinny had the magazine out of the B.A.R. and was feeding shells into it.
Costing a lot of money, Hawk said. Support you and me and five tough guys.
They could get the sheriff's department to clean out the Dell for zip, I said.
Except they afraid to testify.
So why aren't they afraid to hire us? You think the Dell won't know?
So maybe they ain't so scared, Hawk said.
Or maybe they are, I said. But there's something at stake that's worth the risk.
Which they couldn't get if the cops came in, Hawk said.
Vinny put the full clip back in the B.A.R., worked the action once, caught the ejected shell in midair, took the magazine out, and reloaded the shell.
Works good, he said.
Chapter 43 Bobby Horse took Hawk and me slowly up the back slope of the hill behind the Dell. It was steep and littered with shale and spiky with dry desert growth. We took 2.5 hours to get to the top, and another 30 minutes to reach the rim where the hill dropped off perpendicularly and formed the back wall of the Dell. Flat on our stomachs, screened by the scrub growth that hung onto the canyon, we could see the Quonset huts of the preacher's crew straight below us, and beyond, where the canyon dropped off again as it stepped down toward the desert, the town clustered on the otherwise empty flat land. To our left was the ravine that led into the canyon, through which I came to visit the preacher. It was the only way in, which made the place secure. It was also the only way out.
"Hard to get in there," Hawk said.
I said, "Uh-huh."
"Hard to get out of there."
"Uh-huh." The heavy dry heat was battering. Sweat dried at once.
"Dumb," Hawk said. "All they saw was how hard it was to get in."
"They didn't choose the site," I said. "It was just sort of there, where the mine was, and I don't think they ever thought they'd have to get out."
"Probably didn't think there'd be anyone willing to make the fucking climb," Hawk said to me. "You be the only one I could think of."
Bobby Horse passed around a big canteen and we all drank some water. The water was hot.
"It's not boiling," I said, "so the temperature must be less than 212. "What temperature you suppose ammunition start exploding?" Hawk said.
We were all silent, staring down at the Dell.
"Put some people up here," Bobby Horse said, "and some people at the ravine down there, and we can shoot them to pieces."
I was going to say something about fish in a barrel, but the imagery didn't seem quite right for the parched furnace below us. "We'll keep it in mind," I said.
"Why not just do it?" Bobby Horse said.
"He too sweet-natured," Hawk said to Bobby Horse.
"Besides," I said, "means we'd have to climb down, get people together, and climb back up here with rifles."
"I'd be one of the folks at the ravine," Hawk said.
"If it comes to that, we'll draw straws," I said.
"Except me. As you pointed out, I'm your employer."
"I believe you discriminating racially," Hawk said, "'gainst me and my Native American sidekick."
"You were the one said we needed to know more before we started shooting," I said.
"I didn't mean it," Hawk said.
Bobby Horse paid no attention to us as he stared down at the Dell.
"Looks like a generator shack over there," he said.
"Yes," I said, "you can see the hookups to the other buildings."
"Where's the fuel?" Hawk said. "Barrels," Bobby Horse said. "Other side of the building. They set one on a high stand and run a hose into the generator. Works on gravity."
"You got a look at the other side?" Hawk said.
"Me and Cholo," Bobby Horse said. "We went over to that little jut at the end of the canyon."
"No wonder Cholo didn't want to come again," I said.
"Mexicans tire easy," Bobby Horse said.
We looked at the Dell some more. There was a large steak-body truck parked near the generator shack. It was probably used to haul the fuel oil.
"Might be good to take that generator out," Bobby Horse said. "No lights, no television, no A.C.
"Water be pumped up from a well," Hawk said. "So no running water."
"How we gonna take it out?"
"I go down," Bobby Horse said.
"You could get down there?"
"Sure."
"And back?"
"Sure."
"We'll keep it in mind," I said. We lay for a while baking at the top of the cliff looking at the dell. When I went in to talk to the preacher, when I was here before, nobody stopped me. I didn't see any sentries. Bobby Horse pointed toward the ravine. Hawk and I looked. I saw nothing.
"Keep looking," Bobby Horse said. "Near the top of the ravine, a cluster of scrub. Just below it, a ledge. Under the ledge."
I found the scrub and the ledge and kept looking. Then I saw a glint of light reflecting from under the ledge.
"Gun barrel," Bobby Horse said. "Belt buckle, sunglasses, maybe a wristwatch."
"How many you think?" I said.
"Two," Bobby Horse said.
There was no uncertainty in his voice. "So they let me in because I was alone and not carrying any visible weapons," I said.
"Probably thought you was a tourist got lost," Bobby Horse said.
"Or a dashing soldier of fortune," I said, "and they hope to recruit me."
"We put somebody at the ravine," Hawk said. "We need to eliminate them first." "I can do that," Bobby Horse said.
"Both of them?" I said.
"Sure." "You Native Americans are scary," Hawk said. "Heap scary," Bobby Horse said.
"Talk funny, too," I said. We stayed on our bellies and stared down through the shimmering that rose from the canyon floor until most of our water was gone and we had internalized the layout of the dell. Then we edged away from the rim, stood, and walked the half-hour walk back to the downslope of the hill behind the dell.
"We got the people to do this," Hawk said as we started the long scramble back down. "You put the shooters up here, Vinny, Cholo, maybe the little hard case from Vegas. Me and you do the close work in the ravine with Teddy Sapp and Bobby Horse."
"If we need to," I said.
"How are you going to know if we need to?"
"When I figure out what's happening here. I'm not going to slaughter a bunch of people and then find out we didn't have to." Hawk shook his head slowly.
"A sweet nature," he said. "A sweet fucking nature."
Chapter 44. When we got back to the house, there was a silver Lexus parked in front, and Cholo was sitting on the front porch with Morris Tannenbaum's guy with the horn-rimmed glasses, who looked like an accountant and wasn't.
"You remember Ronnie?" Cholo said.
"With pleasure," I said.
Bobby Horse paid no attention to Ronnie. He went on past them and into the house. Hawk didn't say anything, but he looked steadily at Ronnie. Ronnie looked at Hawk for a time and then turned his attention to me. Hawk leaned against the porch railing, still looking at Ronnie.
"Hot," Ronnie said.
He was wearing a white linen suit with a flowered sports shirt open at the neck. His shoes were woven leather. He looked like an accountant on vacation.
"Yeah," I said, "but it's a dry heat." Ronnie nodded as if the heat were a real topic. I waited.
"Morris wanted me to talk with you," Ronnie said.
"You always do what Morris wants," I said.
"Yeah."
I waited some more. Ronnie seemed in no hurry. Hawk was motionless against the railing. Cholo might have been asleep in his chair.
"Morris wanted me to tell you things have changed a little," Ronnie said.
"Uh-huh."
"Morris says he got no further interests out here."
"Which means?"
"Morris says if you want to take out the dell, he'll give you a walk on that."
Last I knew, he was going to have somebody shoot me if I didn't leave things alone out here.
"Probably me," Ronnie said. "That ain't the case anymore."
"Well, isn't that nice," I said. "How about Mary Lou Buckman?"
"Morris got no interest in her."
"But he used to," I said. Ronnie spread his hands, palms up, and shrugged.
"What happened?" I said.
Ronnie shook his head.
"Morris didn't have anybody shoot Steve Buckman, did he?"
"Nope."
"You sure?" "I'd do Morris's shooting," Ronnie said. "I didn't do Buckman."
"You know who did?"
"Maybe she did," Ronnie said.
"Why do you think so?"
"Wives shoot husbands a lot," Ronnie said.
"What's Morris's connection to her?" Maybe they were bridge partners. Morris only tells me what I need to know.
And his connection to the Dell?
Same answer, Ronnie said.
So Morris sent you all the way out here just to tell me it was okay to do what I was going to do anyway, I said.
We had no way to know you was going to do it, Ronnie said.
What the hell was I doing here, then?
Maybe shagging after Mrs. Buckman, Ronnie said.
With half a dozen thugs?
Ronnie smiled. It was a thin gesture, but unexpected.
Maybe to hold her down, he said.
I'll be damned. A romantic underneath it all.
Ronnie hitched up a pant leg and crossed his right leg over his left. He bobbed his right foot a little, looking at the toe of his shoe as if it were interesting.
Morris says he'd like to make a financial contribution to the project, Ronnie said.
Which project is that, I said.
Snuffin' the Dell.
How about Mary Lou?
Leave her on her own.
You mean don't look after her, I said.
Let things develop, he said. Stay focused on the Dell.
How much of a financial contribution is Morris likely to make, I said.
You could pretty much name it, Ronnie said, if you can deliver.
But no manpower, I said.
Nope.
Why not?
Morris figures you don't need it.
How flattering, I said.
Cholo and Bobby Horse are good, Ronnie said.
You are too kind, senor, Cholo said.
Ronnie nodded at Hawk.
This guy's good, he said.
Hawk registered nothing.
You can tell, I said.
I can tell, Ronnie said.
You too.
You know anything about Dean Walker?
Police chief out here, isn't he?
No more than that?
Nope.
How do you know that?
I'm alert, Ronnie said.
What about Mark Ratliff?
Movie producer, Ronnie said, except he don't produce no movies.
Anything else?
Nope.
And how do you know about him?
Ronnie smiled the thin smile again.
Alertness, he said.
I'm pretty alert myself, I said. And I noticed that Morris is hiring me to do what he said he'd kill me for a month ago.
Things change, Ronnie said.
But you wouldn't know why.
I wouldn't, Ronnie said.
Like I said, Morris only tells me what he thinks I need to know.
Why don't I believe you, I said.
Because you're a cynical and suspicious guy, Ronnie said.
That must be it, I said.
We sat. Hawk leaned. I tried to think of some clever way to trick Ronnie into telling more than he wanted to. I couldn't. I was cynical and suspicious, but not that bright.
Tell Morris that I will decline his kind offer, and if anything happens to Mary Lou Buckman, I will come to L.A. and fry his ass.
I'll pass that on, Ronnie said.
He got up and headed for his car. Hawk watched him all the way. Cholo didn't move, but I realized he was watching Ronnie, too.
Ronnie went around his car and opened the driver's side door. He looked back at us.
Have a nice day, he said.
Then he got in the car and closed the door and backed it slowly out of the driveway.
Chapter 45. It was Bernard's turn to cook breakfast. He valued presentation. He always put out a tablecloth and matching flatware. He put the juice in a pitcher and the milk in another. No cartons on the table. He served the meals from the counter instead of slopping the food out of the cooking pan at the table. Today he was serving apricot pancakes with syrup made from some sort of cactus pear.
Bernard, Teddy Sapp said, you sure you're straight?
Damned right I'm straight, Bernard said. Anybody says I'm not, I'll fight him.
Sapp grinned.
When a gay guy calls you queer, it's not an insult, he said.
You think I wouldn't fight you? Bernard said.
I think you would, Sapp said. Just not for long.
Bernard put three pancakes on a dinner plate and brought it to the table.
Well, you just mess with me, he said. We'll find out how long.
Sapp's grin grew wider. He said,
I wouldn't mess with you, Bernard.
Bernard put my pancakes down in front of me. They were carefully arranged on the plate so that they didn't overlap. I put just enough honey on and cut off a bite and ate it. When I had swallowed, I said,
You can really cook for a straight guy, Bernard.
Don't you start with me, he said.
Why would Morris Tannenbaum send Ronnie here? Cholo said.
I figure he got double-crossed, I said.
By who?
Everybody involved.
Which is who? Hawk said.
I'll get back to you on that, I said.
He has many resources, Cholo said. Why not send Ronnie and some people out here, straighten it out himself?
Why, I said, if we'll do it for him.
Why does he wish to pay us for something we're going to do, even if he does not?
I looked at Hawk.
"'Cause he'd been double-crossed,' Hawk said, "'and he can't let no one do that and get off. "'So he wants it to be him paid us.'
"'Cholo looked at me. I nodded. "'Be my guess,' I said.
"'You have not ever met the man.'
"'Magical, ain't it?' Hawk said.
"'So why not permit him to pay us?' Cholo said.
"'Step at a time,' I said. "'First, let's shove the preacher a little.'
"'About time.' Vinny murmured.
Hawk looked at him. Vinny shrugged and didn't say more. Vinny looked up to Hawk.
"'We going to go in after them?' Cholo said.
"'Not yet,' I said. "'We interfere with their ability to do business. See what it brings us.'
"'You think you can get them to bargain?' Sapp said.
"'He thinks he can get them to tell him who killed Buckman.'
"'He does?' Sapp said.
"'That how he is,' Hawk said.
Bernard came from the counter with his own plate of pancakes and sat down. He tucked his napkin into his collar and picked up his knife and fork.
"'Why does he care who killed Buckman?' Bernard said.
"'Hawk's right,' Cholo said. "'I worked with him before. What was the name of that place where we found the broad?'
"'Proctor,' I said.
"'Yeah, Proctor,' Cholo said. "'Up outside Boston. When I was up there with him, he worried about things that the rest of us don't worry so much about.'
Cholo looked at Sapp.
"'Sept maybe him," he said.
"'That's a mean thing to say to me,' Sapp said. "'Today's Wednesday,' I said. "'The preacher and his associates come into town on Thursday and collect money from the town.'
"'You going to brace them, then?' Sapp said.
"'He won't do nothing that simple,' Vinny said.
"'We're going to watch them,' I said. "'See who they collect from and when.' Then we look around town and figure out, knowing the collection pattern, if we can develop a game plan, which does not involve shooting a bunch of civilians while we're bracing them.
See?
Vinny said. Bobby Horse had said nothing, eating six pancakes in the process. Now he looked up.
Good plan, he said.
Might make sense, Hawk said. We go in today, look around.
I had just poured a second cup of coffee. I added milk and a lot of sugar and stirred it carefully. It would, I said, but not as a group. Just drift in individually, maybe a couple guys together.
I'll go in with Teddy, Bernard said.
I'd be honored, Sapp said.
What you gonna do, Hawk said.
How do you know he's not gonna go in with us, Bernard said.
Hawk smiled and didn't answer. I'm gonna go and talk with Mary Lou.
"'Bout time,' Hawk said.
"'It is,' I said.
Chapter 46 The Rattlesnake Cafe was long and narrow, with an open kitchen to the right and high-back wooden booths along the left wall. The ceiling was tin. The booths were painted with desert scenes. The tabletops were Mexican tile. Mary Lou Buckman and I sat in the first booth, and I, mindful of Wild Bill Hickok, sat facing the door. We were reading the menus. Among the choices were a chicken breast sandwich on sourdough bread with sprouts, blackened salmon, a desert burger with green chili relish, and a cactus club sandwich. Bernard J. Fortunato's apricot pancakes were sticking grimly to my ribs, and, an oddity for me, I wasn't very hungry. Mary Lou decided on the desert burger. I ordered the cactus club to be sociable. We both had iced tea. "'What is the occasion for this lunch?' Mary Lou said. "'Not, of course, that I'm not thrilled to see you.' She was wearing a white baseball cap, the kind where you can adjust the size by moving a plastic strap in the back. Her blonde hair was spooled through the adjustment opening and hung in a long braid to her shoulders. Her dark blue tank top revealed a little self-effacing cleavage, and I had noticed when she walked in that her white shorts were well-fitted. "'That would be one reason,' I said. "'The other is that I'm your employee. "'It seems appropriate for me to report to you now and then.'
She had applied her makeup so adroitly that she looked as if she wore none, except her eyes were bigger and her lashes were thicker than God had intended. She still smelled of good soap, and her tan was still even. Except for the plain gold wedding ring on her left hand, she wore no jewelry. In memoriam. The food arrived. The Cactus Club contained chicken, tomato, bacon, and lettuce, but no cactus. "Very well," she said, and smiled a little. "Report." "I've been to L.A., I said. She had a bite of desert burger in her mouth. She raised her eyebrows and said nothing. "There are several people there who allege that both you and your husband fooled around." She blushed. It had been so long since I had seen someone blush that it took me a moment to be sure what she was doing. She swallowed and took her napkin from her lap and patted her mouth with it and put the napkin back in her lap. "Steve and I had an open marriage," she said. "People allege that a couple of the people you fooled around with are Mark Ratliff and Dean Walker." She stared at me without speaking for a time. I waited. Finally, she said, "Why do you feel the need to investigate my private life?" "It's what I do," I said. "I investigate stuff." "It is not what you were hired to do." "While I was in L.A., a big old ugly hoodlum warned me to stay away from you or he'd kill me."
"My God."
"He also told me to stay away from the Dell." Mary Lou seemed to have forgotten her desert burger.
"What does this all mean?" she said.
"It means that a guy who pretty much runs the rackets east of L.A. is interested in you and the Dell. It means that two men, at least, who knew you, intimately, appear to have followed you out here."
"They didn't follow me."
I nodded. "I never had anything to do with either one of them."
"Guy who warned me off is named Morris Tannenbaum," I said.
"I never heard of him," she said. "I don't know what all this is about."
"I'm just reporting," I said, "and this is what I've got to report."
"Well, it doesn't feel that way," she said. "It feels like you're accusing me."
"Of what?"
"I don't know of what. Do you think I killed my husband?"
"It would have been sensible, when you hired me to look into his death, if you'd told me a little more about your past and its connection to your present," I said.
"I don't even know what that means," she said.
She seemed like she might cry soon.
"I'm alone here. A gang of thugs killed my husband. I turned to you for help. I had nowhere else to turn."
"What do you suppose is out here that would interest Morris Tannenbaum?" I said.
"Who?"
"The racketeer," I said. "Remember?"
"Oh, yes."
"What would be his interest?"
"I can't imagine."
"You worked once for the DWP in L.A., I said.
She stared silently ahead, not making eye contact. Then she began to moan softly.
"I wanted you to help me," she said between moans. "Why won't you help me?"
"You had a job in Water Resource," I said.
"I can't do this," she said. "I can't."
She stood up and walked out. Chapter 47. It was cooler once the sun went down. Hawk and I sat on the front porch of the Jackrabbit Inn, drinking Coors beer from long-necked bottles and looking at the darkening street.
"So Mary Lou told you shit," Hawk said.
"She told me I was the only one who could help her," I said.
"Probably the first guy she ever said that to."
Hawk was wearing faded blue jeans and a copper-colored silk tweed jacket over a white shirt. His mahogany-colored cowboy boots gleamed with polish. Everything fit him flawlessly. I knew that he was wearing his gun at the small of his back so as not to break the drape.
"I'm very special to her," I said.
"Uh-huh. She say anything about Walker and Ratliff?"
"She said they weren't intimate."
"We believe her, don't we?" Hawk said.
"There's a lot she isn't saying," I said.
"We knew that before you talked with her," Hawk said.
"Well, we know it again," I said.
"Skilled interrogation be the keystone of detective work," Hawk said.
"Yes, it be," I said.
"Snooping around town worked pretty well, too."
"The Dell came in for collections," I said.
"Uh-huh. Two jeep loads. Actually, one a jeep, the other one an old scout. Don't even make any more."
"I've seen it," I said. "What time?" 10:20 in the morning, Hawk said.
Not early birds, I said.
Still got themselves a worm, though.
Preacher come with them?
Casper the ghost, Hawk said. Skinny, no hair?
That's him.
He done the collecting, Hawk said. Started down there, head of the street, at the Westernware store, and worked right down Main Street.
How much backup?
7, besides him. 4 in each vehicle. When he went in the stores, a big fat guy went with him, carried the black bag.
Pony, I said.
Pony?
That's his name.
Guy's big enough to haul a beer wagon.
Maybe they're being ironic, I said.
That's probably it, Hawk said. I bet there's a lot of irony out there in the old Dell.
What'd the other guys do while the preacher was collecting?
Moved along down the street with him, Hawk said. Stayed in the vehicles while preacher and pony went in.
Weapons?
Handguns, probably. I didn't see anything bigger.
When Hawk was engaged by something, he occasionally forgot his mocking black accent. It was how you could tell he was engaged.
This is beginning to sound easy, I said.
It'll be easy, Hawk said.
They know we're here, I said.
Probably. But the preacher's been the stud horse around here a long time. He's so used to not having trouble that he forgot there is any. My guess, he don't care if we're here.
You working on a plan, I said.
Hawk nodded toward the head of the street.
We park Sap in one car up there, he said, and we put Bobby Horse in the other car, at the bottom of the street. Cholo in the alley there, Hawk pointed with his chin at a point midway along Main Street. The little Vegas guy,
Bernard, I said, Bernard J. Fortunato.
Him, Hawk said, across and down a little, between the bakery and the drugstore, and Vinny in the hotel window, top floor.
Why, Vinny, I said.
Best shooter, Hawk said.
I'm not sure he's better than Cholo, I said.
He ain't worse, Hawk said.
No, you're right. Vinny's in the window, which leaves you and me to brace Pony and the preacher.
Best for last, Hawk said, and took a pull at his beer.
Okay, I said. That'll work.
Course it'll work, Hawk said. You just jealous you didn't think it up.
How hard was it to think up, I said.
That's not the point, Hawk said.
Of course it isn't, I said. Next week we'll implement your plan.
Hot diggity, Hawk said.
Chapter 48 J. George Taylor asked me to come talk with him. Except for J. George, the office was empty when I got there.
Mary Lou says you've been questioning her, he said, after I was seated in his client chair.
She does, I said.
She feels you are somewhat accusative.
And she complained to you?
We're friends. Since her husband's death, I have been looking out for her, sort of like a father.
Sort of, I said.
And I really think she needs a gentle touch. For God's sake, her husband was murdered.
By the Dell, I said.
Of course by the Dell.
You know this.
Everyone knew he was standing up to the Dell. Everyone knew they had threatened him.
Who did the actual threatening?
The Dell.
Which one?
The preacher.
You heard him?
No, it was his, brute, Pony.
You heard Pony threaten Steve?
Of course, half the town heard him.
Who besides you specifically?
Oh, for God's sake, J. George said. The mayor heard him. Luther Barnes, Mark Ratliff, Henry Brown, about 2 dozen other people in the bar.
Which bar?
The bar at the Jackrabbit.
Tell me about it.
Nothing to tell, J. George said. Steve was at the bar having a beer. Pony walked in and went right up to him and threatened him.
With death?
Yes.
What did he say?
Pony? I don't remember exactly. They had an argument and Steve was shouting, and Pony tapped him on the chest with his forefinger and said to him, "You're a dead man."
How did Steve react?
He just stared at Pony. He wouldn't admit it later, but I think he was scared. Pony is... My God, Pony is terrifying.
I've seen him.
And?
Terrifying, I said.
But we've gotten off the track, J. George said. I really wanted to urge you to go easy on Mary Lou.
You bet, I said. You know anybody named Morris Tannenbaum?
J. George leaned back in his chair and looked thoughtful.
Morris Tannenbaum, he said.
Yes.
No, I can't say that I have. spend much time in Los Angeles?" I said. "No more than I must," J. George said. "Will you be able to give Mary Lou a little more space?"
"Of course," I said. "Sorry I upset her."
J. George stood and put out his hand.
I know," J. George said. "Just trying to do your job. Women are difficult."
I shook his hand and smiled as if I believed everything he said. Outside, I forged bravely through the heat to the Jackrabbit Inn. Bebe was at a table having lunch with another woman. There were some papers between them. I smiled at Bebe and went to the bar. The bartender came down to me and put a paper doily on the bar in front of me.
"What can I get you?" he said.
"Were you working the bar?" I said, when Pony threatened Steve Buckman.
"I got nothing to say about that," the bartender said.
"It's just background," I said. "I'll never quote you." I put a $100 bill on the bar. The bartender looked at it, and then palmed it off the bar in a move so expert that the bill seemed to disappear magically.
"You do, and I'll say you're lying."
"Sure," I said.
"Yeah, I was here."
"Tell me about it."
"Steve's at the bar. This monstrous big dude from the Dell comes in. Him and Steve have an argument. The dude says to Steve, 'You're a dead man,' and walks out."
"The big dude was Pony?"
"Yeah."
The bartender went down the bar and got drink orders from a couple of blonde women in tennis whites. He mixed two cosmopolitans and poured them out into two glasses, and it came out just right. He put the drinks in front of the blondes, rang the tab, put it in the bar gutter in front of them, and came back down the bar to me.
"You want something to drink?"
"Sure. Give me a Perrier with a slice of orange in it."
"You got it," he said, and reached under the bar. "Ice?"
"Yeah. A lot of people hear him."
"Pony?"
"Yeah.
When he threatened Steve Buckman?"
"It's my only $100, I said. The bartender grinned.
"Can't blame me for trying," he said.
"Sure, a lot of people heard him. Bar was full, all the regulars."
"J. George," I said. "Taylor?"
The bartender glanced at Bebe across the room and lowered his voice.
"Yeah, he was here, and his crew. Barnes, Brown, the mayor."
"Who else?" I said.
"Christ, what am I, a computer? Billy Bates was here with his wife, Mr. and Mrs. Gordon, Ratliff the producer, Tom Paglia."
He put my Perrier down on the little doily. I put a $10 on the bar. He grinned.
"On the house," he said.
The woman across from Bebe stood up. They shook hands. The woman took some of the papers and left. I moved over to her table as Bebe was sliding the remaining paper into her briefcase. She looked up as I sat down across from her.
"Well, hello," she said.
"Hello."
"I just sold a nice Spanish-style ranch to that woman," Bebe said. "She's from Flagstaff. Sick the snow, I guess."
"How is business these days?"
"Hideous," she said. "Nearly everybody wants to sell and nobody wants to buy, unless they're from out of town and don't know about the Dell."
"And you don't feel obligated to tell them?"
"No, I don't," she said. "Real estate prices are dropping like a stone. They used to be really high, because there was nowhere to expand."
"You're in the middle of nowhere," I said. "Why can't you expand?"
"It's all desert," Bebe said. "We've expanded to the limit of our water supply already."
"What if you had enough water?"
"The Dell would ruin sales anyway."
"What if the Dell were gone?"
Bebe smiled at me. "I'd be selling real estate from early in the morning to really late at night," she said.
"Anybody buying property these days?"
"George made a couple of sales to some developers," she said. "I think they'll lose their shirt."
She paused and smiled and shrugged.
"But they're consenting adults," she said.
"Caveat emptor," I said.
The papers were stashed in her little black briefcase. She zipped the top closed and looked up at me from under her eyebrows. "I was a little fuzzy the last time I saw you," she said. "I shouldn't drink on a light breakfast."
"None of us should," I said, "but sometimes we do."
"Did we have a good time?" she said.
I tried to put a lecherous gleam in my eyes. It wasn't hard. I was good at lecherous.
"How quickly they forget," I said. "Was I all right?"
"You certainly were," I said. I wasn't as good at enthusiasm, but she didn't seem to notice.
"I hate not remembering. Maybe we should go over it again sometime."
"Be my pleasure," I said.
"That's what they tell me," Beebe said.
Did you know that Mary Lou knew both Dean Walker and Mark Ratliff in Los Angeles?
"I knew about Mark," Beebe said. "I don't think I knew that about Dean Walker."
"You told me that Mary Lou Buckman was sleeping with both of them."
"And probably some others," Beebe said. "I knew you'd have trouble believing it. Men are so stupid."
"How do you know?"
"About Mary Lou?"
"About Walker and Ratliff," I said.
"Dean Walker is merely surmise," Beebe said, "and intuition."
"And Ratliff?"
Beebe smiled. "Pillow talk," she said.
I nodded and we smiled knowingly. Two insiders. Intimates.
"You mean I'm not the only one," I said.
"Almost."
"He say anything else about her?" I said.
"Mark? About Mary Lou?
Oh, yes. Actually, it was a little annoying. He'd be in bed with me, you know, afterwards, and he'd be blabbing on about how he loved Mary Lou and had followed her to Potshot and would wait forever if he had to, crap like that."
"You didn't believe him?" I said.
"Mark's a Hollywood person," she said. "It's hard to believe a word he speaks."
"And he wasn't waiting for her celibately," I said.
Beebe was good at lecherous gleaming, too.
"Not likely," she said. "But as soon as he was through boffing me, he'd talk about her."
"So she was always on his mind," I said.
Beebe grinned.
"She was always on his mind."
Chapter 49 I called Callie Dark and talked with him for 15 minutes. Then I hung up and went out onto the front porch where Teddy Sapp was taking orders and mixing drinks. The sun had set, quite flamboyantly, and the blue twilight was settling around us the way it does. Bernard J. Fortunato had fixed up a tray of cheese and crackers and was passing it around.
"Bernard went in today and rented the hotel room," Hawk said. "Street side."
"I told him straight when I reserved it what I wanted," Bernard said.
"You see the room?" I said.
"Bet your ass."
"So Vinny's in the window with a rifle," Hawk said.
"Room looks right down on the broad's office," Bernard said.
"Mary Lou's?"
"Yeah, Buckman Outfitters."
"So we'll be sure to brace them there," I said, "in front of her storefront."
"You want us to be surreptitious?" Hawk said.
"Surreptitious?" Sapp said.
Hawk shrugged.
"I educated in Head Start," Hawk said.
"Really worked," Sapp said.
"No reason to be covert," I said.
"You too?" Sapp said.
"Nope," I said. "I'm a straight Anglo-white guy of European ancestry. We're naturally smart."
"You missed Bernard," Sapp said.
"Tall, straight Anglo-white guy," I said.
"Hey," Bernard said.
"Perfect," Sapp said.
"So we all got shotguns but Vinny," Hawk said.
"Sure," I said. "The town fathers hired us to do this. Cops won't interfere."
"You know that?" Vinny said.
"They haven't so far," I said.
"What are you going to use from the window?"
"The heckler,"
Vinny said.
"Good choice," I said.
"Of course it is,"
Vinny said.
"I will use a handgun," Cholo said. "Giving me a shotgun is like asking Picasso to paint with a broom."
Vinny nodded.
"Just what I need," I said. "A couple of divas." I looked at Bobby Horse.
"I suppose you want a bow and arrow," I said.
"Kiowas are flexible," he said.
We were quiet. Sapp went around refreshing drinks.
"Try the blue cheese," Bernard said. "Nice lingering bite to it."
I looked at Hawk.
"J. George Taylor talked with me today," I said. "Asked me not to annoy Mary Lou."
"Well, then, you better not," Hawk said.
"Then I had a club soda with B.B. Taylor," I said.
"I thought you was going to introduce me," Hawk said.
"I thought you liked a challenge," I said.
"Out here getting laid a challenge," Hawk said.
"She said that it was hard to sell real estate because of the Dell."
"Uh-huh."
"She said everybody wants to sell and nobody wants to buy. Real estate prices are dropping like a stone."
"Sure," Bernard said. "That's the old law of supply and demand. So what?"
Hawk sat back in his chair and put his feet up on the railing. He had a small drink of gin and tonic.
"So the natural price for property here been artificially lowered," he said.
"By the Dell."
"So who benefits from that?" Hawk said.
"Anybody wants to pick up some nice bargains."
Hawk nodded.
"Wouldn't be the Dell," he said.
they acquire it, the property values won't increase, I said. Lest they targeting the ex-con market.
Maybe they don't care about that, Sapp said. Maybe they just like living off the carcass.
If the town keeps declining, I said, there won't be any carcass.
Hawk was nodding his head slowly.
But if somebody picked up a lot of real estate and got rid of the Dell, then they make a big profit.
She said even if it were good, the town couldn't expand because of water limitations.
But if somebody discovered a new water source, Hawk said.
Bonanza, I said.
What did Mary Lou Buckman used to do in L.A.?
Water resource specialist, I said.
Fancy that, Hawk said.
Chapter 50. I was back in Collie Dark's office with the air conditioning humming steadily. Dark had on a blue Oxford shirt today. With him was a red-haired guy with a big Adam's apple.
"This is Ray Butler," Dark said. "He's the water resource guy for the county."
Butler and I shook hands. We sat in the two chairs facing Dark's desk.
"I told Ray about your situation down at Potshot. He was real impressed that I was doing legwork for a Boston shoe fly."
"Me too," I said. Dark leaned back and made a go-ahead gesture at me with his right hand. "What's the water situation in Potshot?" I said to Butler.
"The Arapaho Aquifer," he said, "extends from around Salt City in the Sawtooths, maybe 85 miles down through Potshot."
"An aquifer is like an underground river," I said.
"More like an underground sponge," Butler said.
He had a high, sharp voice.
"Which holds water and can be caused to yield it through wells or springs. The water seeps through pores and fractures in consolidated rock or through spaces between the particles if it's unconsolidated."
"Thank you," I said. Leaning back in his chair with his fingers laced over his flat stomach, Dark might have been in a reverie, except that there was a hint of amusement in the way his eyes moved.
"There are, of course, confined aquifers and unconfined aquifers."
"Of course," I said. "Is the Arapaho aquifer sufficient to the needs of Potshot?"
"Barely,"
Butler said. "Does that limit development?"
"Of course it does," Butler keened.
Talking to the likes of me was clearly painful for him. What would happen if the water consumption exceeded the capacity of the aquifer?
"It could not recharge at a pace sufficient to the need."
Everything Butler said sounded like sort of a high-pitched protest. "So they'd run out of water."
"That's what I just said."
"Is there any possibility that there is another aquifer?"
"Of course there is. It would be presumptuous to suggest that we know everything about the substrata."
"Presumptuous," I said. "Is it likely?"
Butler paused. How to say this to an unscientific moron?
"It's possible,"
he said finally. "And if there were an increase in the amount of available water," I said, "then I assume it would support increased development."
"It would make it possible," Butler said, "where right now it is not."
"Anybody been looking for water down there?"
"No."
"How do you know?"
"In this environment, water is very precious," Butler said. "We cannot permit it to be exploited without supervision."
"So how would you know?" I said.
"We'd know."
"How?" Butler was silent. It was impossible that this rube had asked him a question he couldn't answer.
"Do you know how?" I said to Dark.
Dark shook his head.
"There would be evidence of exploration," Butler said.
"When's the last time you looked?" Again, Butler was silent. After a while, Dark said, "Well, thank you very much, Ray. I don't believe we'll be needing anything else." Butler stood and shook hands with me, sourly, I thought, and departed.
"Ray's never met a man he didn't like," Dark said.
"Be fun to drink beer with," I said.
"If you drank a real lot," Dark said.
"You able to get anyone to check the real estate?"
"Course I did," Dark said. "I'm the goddamn police."
"And?"
"And I had somebody go over to the county hall, like you wanted, and look up real estate transactions in and around Potshot. Here's a list."
Dark handed me the list.
"Recognize any names?" he said.
"Couple," I said. "Who's this Saguaro Development Associates?"
"Thought you'd ask me that," Dark said.
He handed me another sheet.
"Recognize any names?" he said.
"All of them," I said. I took it and folded it over and tucked it in the inside pocket of my elegant, toffee-colored summer silk tweed jacket, which I wore to conceal my somewhat less elegant blue-barreled handgun.
Chapter 51
"We walked through it," Hawk said at breakfast, "without the shotguns."
"Or the heckler,"
Vinny said.
"I have no shotgun," Cholo said.
"Artists are so self-absorbed," I said. "You see anything wrong with the plan?"
"It should be smooth," Hawk said. "Vinny got a nice view of the street. We do it right, we'll be right up against them before they got any idea we're there."
"I want to get a look at Pony," Teddy Sapp said.
"Be easy to spot him," Hawk said.
Sapp poured himself more coffee.
"For Christ's sake, Teddy," Bernard said. "How many cups is that?"
"Six."
"Don't you get all jeeped up?" Bernard said.
"Sure," Teddy said. "It's why I drink it."
"You learn anything yesterday worth knowing?" Hawk said to me.
"Potshot can't get any bigger," I said, "unless there's an additional source of water."
"Like somebody finds an underground river?" Hawk said.
I shook my head pityingly.
"It's a common misconception," I said, "that water flows underground like a river. Most aquifers are better thought of as a giant sponge which holds the water. One such aquifer, the Arapaho Aquifer, supplies the water currently sustaining Potshot."
"Anglos are generally dull," Cholo said. "But you, senor, you are truly so."
"So are there any other underground sponges beside the Arapaho thing?" Hawk said.
"My expert does not know, which makes him very unhappy, but he says it's possible."
"So if someone found one," Sapp said. "And kept their mouth shut," Hawk said.
"And perhaps purchased some land? Cheap?" I took my list out of my pocket and spread it on the table. Beside it, I put the list of names of people who comprised the Saguaro Development Associates. Everybody looked at both papers while I waited, watching enviously as Sapp polished off his sixth cup of coffee.
"Appears that we employed by Saguaro Associates," Hawk said.
"J. George Taylor," Bernard read aloud, "Luther M. Barnes, Henry F. Brown, Roscoe B. Land, Mary Louise Allard."
"Read it again, Bernard," Teddy Sapp said. "It was like listening to music."
Bernard ignored Sapp.
"Who's this Mary Louise Allard?" he said.
"Our own Mary Lou," I said.
"Allard is her maiden name." Everyone was quiet for a while. Then Vinny said,
"So what the hell does that mean?"
"Means we're in the middle of some kind of very big swindle," Sapp said.
"So whose side are we on?" Cholo said.
"I'm not sure," I said.
Hawk said, "Preacher might know."
"Yeah," I said. "He might."
Chapter 52 Hawk and I sat in the dark on the front porch of the Jackrabbit Inn drinking coffee and waiting for the light. When it finally arrived, it came slowly, from behind us, seeping up over the hotel until it splashed gray, barely perceptible, onto the street in front of us. Hawk poured some more coffee from the thermos. On the street there was no movement beyond the pale creeping illumination of the morning.
"You figure the preacher an early riser?" Hawk said.
I wanted everything in place.
"That's for sure."
We sat some more, sipping the coffee, looking at the inactive town, waiting. A yellow cat eased across the street and disappeared down the alley to the left of Mary Lou's storefront. Somewhere from the rooftops we could hear the twitter of birds.
"You know this ain't the best way," Hawk said.
I didn't say anything. The coffee smell was strong and comforting in the unsullied morning air.
"Best way," Hawk said, just as if I'd asked him, "be to pen them into that canyon and shoot them from up above." I nodded.
"You know that, well as I do," Hawk said.
I nodded. "But we're going to do it this way."
I nodded.
"Being your faithful Afro-American companion ain't the easiest thing I ever done."
"But think of the positive side," I said.
"Which is?"
"Let me get back to you on that," I said.
The light had spread across the street and past Mary Lou's storefront. Behind it came sunshine, still weak but tinged with color, and carrying with it the promise of heat. I could feel the tension begin to knot. Hawk showed nothing. I'd never seen him show anything. He'd been cool for so long that if there were something to show, he probably wouldn't know it. Hawk drank more coffee, looked out over the rim of the cup along the now bright street.
"Need donuts," Hawk said.
"Try not to think about it," I said. A few people began to appear. There were a couple of 40-ish women in sneakers, shorts, and tank tops, power walking on the sidewalk across the street. Some of the shops began to open. Doors were unlocked. Shades went up. Mary Lou, her hair held back by a blue-and-white polka-dot headband, opened up on the other side. If she saw us, she chose not to acknowledge it. In the hotel kitchen, they were cooking bacon. The yellow cat reappeared, looking satisfied, and pattered down the sidewalk away from us with his tail in the air.
"Bet he had a donut," Hawk said.
We were out of coffee. The street was bright now and hot. Hawk seemed almost asleep in the chair beside me. His eyes were invisible behind his sunglasses, his gun concealed by a light silk warm-up jacket, the sleeves of which were tight over his upper arm. Cars began to appear. More shops opened along the street. People spruced up for the morning walked past the hotel. Many of them trailed a hint of cologne and shampoo and shaving soap in the still air. One of Potshot's two police cruisers rolled slowly down toward the station. Hawk watched it go by, his head turning slowly to follow it. Otherwise, he was motionless.
"We follow that cruiser," he said. "We find donuts. Cops always know where their donuts."
"Ever have a Krispy Kreme donut?" I said.
"No."
"Me neither." The sun had gotten high enough to shine straight into the windows of the shops across the street when they came. The old scout was first, and even from a distance, as it turned into Main Street, I could see the preacher, a contrast in pallor and black, sitting in front in the passenger seat. There were three other men, one of whom was almost certainly Pony, looming in the back seat. The scout canted toward his side. Behind them came a ratty-looking Jeep Wrangler that might once have been blue. There were four men in it.
"Maybe we can get a donut after," Hawk said.
He got up and took off his jacket. He was wearing his big .44 in a shoulder rig, and there was no further need to hide it. We walked across the street and stood in front of Mary Lou's store, Hawk on my left. The preacher saw us and said something to the driver, and he kept coming, and the second car followed until he pulled up to a stop in front of us. The preacher gestured, and the two cars emptied, leaving only the preacher and his driver still seated. Pony was in front of me, but he was aware of Hawk. I could see his eyes shift over and back. The others spread out around us in a semicircle. No one spoke. The preacher seemed almost amused. Peripherally, I could see Teddy Sapp's car move slowly in from the north end of the street, and Bobby Horse drive up from the south. Otherwise, nothing moved in the street.
"So, who are you?"
the preacher said finally.
"Wyatt fucking Earp?"
"I got some questions," I said. The preacher smiled.
"Pony,"
he said. Pony took a step toward us, and Hawk's gun barrel was suddenly pressed against his forehead. Guns came out all around us. The sound of hammers thumbed back was brisk in the hot silence. The preacher showed no expression. Everything stopped, stock still. Behind the preacher, to my left, Teddy Sapp was out of his car and his elbows resting on the hood and the shotgun leveled. To the right, Bobby Horse was the same. "The ball goes up," I said to Teddy Sapp. "Kill the preacher first." My voice seemed blatant in the cavernous silence. The men in front of us glanced quickly around. Cholo walked out of the alley behind us, his Glock 9mm handgun hanging loosely by his side.
"Let me kill him," Cholo said.
His voice was amplified by the silence, as mine had been. Bernard J. Fortunato, with his shotgun at his shoulder, stepped out across the street. He didn't speak, but the shotgun was steady. From the second-floor window of the hotel I heard Vinny,
I couldn't see him, but the barrel